is across the occupied West Bank. Settler gangs have stormed Bira near Ramallah, setting fire to Palestinian property and vehicles. Footage from the incident showed several charred cars and building walls where the vehicles were torched by settlers. Meanwhile, the Israeli military has raided several areas across the West Bank. The troopers abducted at least three Palestinian youths during the incursions. They also ransacked several homes in a village in Al-Khalil Governorate. Israel has intensified violence against Palestinians since the regime began the onslaught on Gaza a year ago. Since then, the regime forces have killed nearly 770 Palestinians and abducted at least 11,500 others. Earlier we talked to our correspondent in Ramallah, Naka Hamid. She says the incident in Bireh was unprecedented, as no such settler attack this deep inside the Palestinian neighborhoods was recorded before.
Settlers from a nearby settlement attacked Al-Bira city, burning down 20 Palestinian cars and two residential buildings. Fortunately, no human losses were recorded, and many incidents followed the operation of the burning of setting the flames to these properties, as when other nearby Palestinians tried to come to put out the fire, they were faced with a shooting of live ammunition against them. And when the staff of the PRCS, which is the Palestinian Red Crescent Society, ambulances tried to reach to the area where the settlers were attacking the Palestinians, they were faced with direct shooting. As eyewitnesses have told us, the attack was unprecedented. It is not the first time that the settlers attack Al-Bira and the surrounding areas of Al-Bira, but it is the first time that the settlers reach into the Palestinian neighborhoods deep inside a Palestinian neighborhood this deep. Since the last 13 months, since the beginning of the genocidal war in Gaza, the settlers' attacks have increased tremendously. We are talking about more than 2,000 attacks in the last year. Those the ones that were documented, not to mention the ones that that Palestinians did not report.
The Israeli regime presses ahead with its deadly raids on Lebanon, targeting the country's hospitals and medical centers. The Israeli military carried out a raid on the vicinity of a hospital in the southern town of Tabnin, causing severe damage and injuring at least 10 civilians. Another hospital in the eastern city of Baalbek, which was crowded with patients, was also struck and sustained material damage. Meanwhile, an Israeli raid on the town of Mushgara in western Bekaa killed 5 and injured 3. The southern town of Bazariya also witnessed a raid that killed at least 2 paramedics there. According to a previous statement by the WHO, at least 85 Lebanese health workers have been killed and dozens more wounded since late September. According to the Lebanese Health Ministry, over 2,900 have been killed and 13,000 others injured since the start of the Israeli aggression against the country in October of last year. The Hezbollah resistance movement presses ahead with its retaliatory operations against Israel, targeting the regime's military positions deep inside the occupied territories. In one of its latest operations, the group targeted the Israeli Army's Eliakim training base south of Haifa with a squadron of drones. Hezbollah also targeted a group of Israeli forces in the Matula settlement with a guided missile, killing and injuring them. The resistance group targeted the Beit Lid military base east of the occupied city of Netanya with a barrage of missiles. The headquarters of Israel's Western Brigade Command in the Yara barracks was also targeted with a drone. The movement's air defense unit forced an Israeli Hermes 900 drone to leave Lebanon's airspace over the Iklim al-Tufa region. Hezbollah's missile barrages also hit for the first time the Haifa technical base, which is used to train the regime's Air Force technicians. Hezbollah carried out several more operations targeting Israeli soldiers in a number of settlements across the occupied territories. Israel has informed the UN that it has ended the 1967 agreement recognizing Palestinian refugee agency UNRWA. This comes after Israeli parliament, or the Knesset, banned UNRWA from operating in the occupied Palestinian territories. Israel has accused employees of the UN agency of taking part in last year's Al-Aqsa flood operation without providing any evidence. The UN has warned against the devastating impact of UNRWA ban on the humanitarian situation in Gaza and the occupied territories. The UN Security Council also expressed grave concern over Israel's decision, calling on the regime to abide by its international obligations. Israel, under international law, is an occupying regime and must implement mechanisms for aiding the people living in that occupied territory. Booker Ngusa is a member of the Kenya-Palestine Solidarity Movement, who joins us from Nairobi. Welcome. When you take a look at the reason why Israel has done this, which now it has formalized it by informing the UN of it, what do you think are the ulterior motives here?
First of all, the attack on the humanitarian organization has been part of the calculated attacks on the Gaza. Because remember that the collective punishment that the Israel regime will want to impose against the residents of Gaza is not just about the carpet bombing. They have been trying to starve Gaza from essentials. And even before this formal notification of the Zionist regime to the United Nations about UNRWA, there was already an ongoing propaganda campaign against the humanitarian workers, particularly UNRWA, that has been at the center of, bringing at least dignity to the Palestinian people. So this is just another offensive to actually bolster their propaganda that, remember, they have indicated previously that Hamas has been trying to use the employees of UNRWA. And to make that bold step to take it to the United Nations, Israel will not have done so if they have not gotten a green light from the United States, because their main supporter to violate United Nations declarations and even the international, not just regulations, but the international policies around the United Nations has been bolstered by the United States regime. So again, for us, we are looking at the position that the United States will take in terms of either making sure that they call out on the Israel and the Netanyahu people about, instead of supporting the stoppage of the carnage in Gaza, but instead putting another layer of attack by making sure that the badly needed humanitarian services do not reach the people that actually deserve the most in the Gaza Strip.
One of the things that lies in the part in the decision-making process for the Israeli regime has been the fact that they do not want to recognize any of the descendants of the refugees, therefore erasing the fact that they would have a right of return. And this may be one of the motives behind the banning of UNRWA. Do you think that that is the case?
No, first of all, since the Nakba, this is very anchored on an historical reality in this war against Palestinian people and calculated land theft. Remember, the right of return is an undeniable right. Wherever we have certain conflicts, when those conflicts end or there is a peace agreement that purportedly at one moment was signed, but that purported peace agreement did not in any way deny the Palestinian people the right to return to their land. So the Palestinian refugees, we must continue to insist that even though the Israel will not allow them to return, and we don't expect the Israel regime to allow them to return, because Israel regime is actually a settler colonialism. So their main objective is not, even in Gaza, like we have indicated before, is that the carpet bombing of Gaza is not just about their to advance their propaganda that they want to deal with the terrorist organization, which for us we hold the clearest objective that Hamas is a liberation movement that is fighting just against settler colonialism. But at the center of it is that the Zionist regime will want to continue with their campaign of land theft and make sure that they can dispossess the majority of the Palestinian people's land in Gaza, and refuse that even after there is any agreement that will be signed, because at the very end of it, when peace returned to the Palestinian people, as long as the Israel regime remains as a settler colonial power there, they will never allow the Palestinian refugees to return. So this is, it's a basic principle of any neocolonial and colonial project, that other than the dispossession of land, you also make sure that you lock people out that have been dispossessed of their land by war. But in a nutshell, even build settlements like they have been doing, build hotels, build infrastructure on the land that has actually been stolen from the Palestinian people.
Thank you so much for that. Bukhar Nagesa there, member of the Kenya-Palestine Solidarity Movement from Nairobi. Thank you. Moving on to Yemen, where the Yemeni armed forces say that they will continue to hit all Israeli-linked ships in nearby waters, regardless of any change in their ownership or their flags. The forces' spokesman said that many shipping companies affiliated to Israel are trying to bypass Yemen's punitive measures by selling their assets to other companies or to changing their registration. Brigadier General Yahya Sari warned that all parties dealing with these companies and vessels are subject to punishment and prohibited from crossing the Yemeni armed forces' zone of operations. He added that any change in the ownership or flags of the Israeli-linked ships will not save them from Yemen's measures. Sari added that the Yemeni army will continue its maritime blockade against Israeli-affiliated vessels and keep targeting them until Israel's aggression against Lebanon and Gaza, as well as the siege of the Strip, stop. Iran's president has warned that the country will not leave any aggression against its sovereignty and security unanswered. Masoud Pezeshkian asserted that the leaders of the Zionist regime know that they will receive a crushing response in case of any mistakes against the Islamic Republic. He added that if Israel changed its behavior, agreed to a ceasefire in the region, and stopped bombing innocent civilians, Iran might reconsider the intensity of its response to the regime's recent attack on its military bases. He also slammed the U.S.'s warmongering across the globe, saying that it is also the cause of war in the region by supporting the Zionist regime. Pezeshkian also criticized the hypocritical approach of the U.S. and European countries to the ongoing crises in the region and asked why they veto proposed ceasefire resolutions if they truly oppose the war. Political commentator Ken Stone has talked to us about Israel's latest aggression against Iran and the Islamic Republic's right to respond to the attack.
Following Israel's most recent attack on Iran, Mr. Iravani, Iran's permanent representative at the U.N., appeared before the UN Security Council demanding that the world body take collective action against the Israeli aggressor in accordance with the Charter of the United Nations. Unfortunately, the United Nations failed to take up Mr. Iravani's challenge and failed once again in the task for which it was formed, namely keeping the peace, about 80 years ago, following World War II. So this left for Iran no other option but to say that it would retaliate in accordance with international law for Israel's unprovoked aggression against Iran. Israel enjoys an impunity in international law because it has the backing of the United U.S. Empire, which includes the U.K., the European Union, NATO, and other vassal states, such as my own country, Canada. And so Israel has, under Netanyahu, Mr. Netanyahu has been trying to drag the U.S. into a war with Iran for 30 years.
Palestinians across Gaza have expressed their skepticism for the upcoming U.S. presidential election. They say that regardless of who wins the election, Washington's stance on Israel's genocidal war on the besieged Strip will not change. They have also slammed President Biden over his support for the regime's war crimes. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of World News. Thanks for being with us. It's bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The limelight.
As the fabricated regime of Israel is a product of Britain's imperial machinations, those British politicians who enable its crimes are following a historical pattern. It is a pattern soaked with the blood of Palestinians. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, committing a genocide is clearly not enough for a large bloc within the Zionist regime's ruling coalition. The far-right ministers in the government, backed by some members of Benjamin Netanyahu's Likud party, are intensifying their push for recolonizing Gaza, their goal of building new settlements in a territory subjected to wholesale destruction is equally despicable and logical. It is in keeping with the logic of the Balfour Declaration. The November 1917 document, which kickstarted a process whereby a Jewish regime would be established in Palestine. The anniversary of the declaration is an occasion to reflect on thinking behind it, as well as its consequences. Arthur James Balfour, Britain's foreign secretary at the time, was under no illusions about what he was doing in issuing that pledge of support for the Zionist movement. His declaration did not specify the contours of the regime being envisaged, which was euphemistically described as a national home. Yet, it did prove vital for creating facts on the ground to use more recent Zionist balance. That is precisely what Balfour intended. In 1919, Balfour wrote a letter to David Lloyd George, then Prime Minister, after an Anglican bishop in Al-Quds had queried British policy towards Zionism. Balfour admitted that there was a weak point in Britain's position as it deliberately and rightly declined to accept the principle of self-determination for Palestine. That would mean asking Palestine's indigenous people, whom Balfour called its present inhabitants, for their views. Balfour wrote, if the present inhabitants were consulted, they would unquestionably give an anti-Jewish verdict, adding that we conceive the Jews to have a historic claim to have a home in their ancient land, provided that home can be given them without either dispossessing or oppressing the present inhabitants. It is important to parse Balfour's choice of words. Before the Balfour Declaration, Muslims, Christians and Jews lived in Palestine without major hostility and frequently on friendly and harmonious terms. The anti-Jewish verdict that Balfour wished to avoid would not be directed at Jews because of their ethnicity or religion. It would rather be a verdict against a colonization project which would deny basic rights to Palestinians, despite how Britain contended otherwise. The Balfour Declaration was later enshrined in the League of Nations mandate under which Britain would rule Palestine following the First World War. Winston Churchill championed the declaration repeatedly. Churchill stated in 1921 that the declaration must be regarded as one of the facts definitely established by the triumphant conclusion of the Great War. Churchill was an avid supporter of Zionism. Blake Alcott's The Rape of Palestine demonstrates just how avid a supporter Churchill was. In one 1937 discussion on the Balfour Declaration, Churchill spoke about the good faith of England to the Jews, adding, "We are bound by honour, and I think upon the merits to push this thing as far as we can." Pushing this thing, the colonisation of Palestine, as far as we can, required crushing resistance to the Zionist project. During the same 1937 discussion, Churchill sought to justify Britain's approach by saying, "We have every right to strike hard in support of our authority." Churchill personally authorized brutal repression. As colonial secretary in 1921, he was instrumental in sending a specialized police force to Palestine. It was comprised of men who had previously served in Ireland with the British forces known as the Black and Tans and the Auxiliaries. To this day, the Black and Tans are synonymous with immense cruelty during Ireland's War of Independence. The Black and Tans set fire to entire neighbourhoods of Cork City and Bargian, the hometown in North County, Dublin. As Caroline Elkins writes in her book Legacy of Violence, Palestine came to replace Ireland as the official and unofficial training ground for colonial police indoctrination. By 1943, five out of Palestine's eight district police commissioners had previously served with the Black and Tans in Ireland. Just recently, David Lammy, Britain's foreign secretary, suggested that the seriousness of the term genocide is undermined if it is applied to Israel's current war against Gaza. It is understandable that a senior British politician would try to excuse or downplay the Zionist regime's crimes. The Zionist regime is, after all, seeking to perfect crimes which it learned from Britain. When Britain ran Palestine, it set up a concentration camp and resorted to home demolitions, collective punishment, and imprisonment without charge or trial. Douglas Duff, one of the former Black and Tan members who went on to become a police chief in Palestine, wrote about the torture techniques which he used and possibly pioneered. His memoirs indicate that he introduced the practice now called waterboarding to Palestine. The Zionist regime has kept up the tradition he established. Palestinians kidnapped by the Zionist regime troops now occupying Gaza have undergone waterboarding. Testimony gathered by the United Nations Human Rights Office has found. Arthur James Balfour once expressed the desire to see the strengthening and consolidation of the British Empire. The Balfour Declaration reflected such thinking. It was hoped that the Zionists would form for England a little loyal Jewish Ulster in a sea of potentially hostile Arabism. According to Ronald Storrs, Al-Quds-based military administrator. The irony is that Britain's sponsorship of Zionism helped to weaken the empire. as the Zionist movement felt that colonization was not advancing with sufficient speed, it fell out with Britain in 1940s. Some elements in the movement even conducted bombing and assassination campaigns against the British. Concluding that Palestine was unmanageable, the British eventually had to leave that land with their tails between their legs. The British departed Palestine as Zionist forces they had trained were implementing the Nakba, the mass expulsion of Palestinians from their homes. Although the empire has shrunk, many figures in the British establishment still have an imperial mindset. As the fabricated regime of Israel is a product of Britain's imperial machinations, those British politicians who enable its crimes are following a historical pattern. It is a pattern soaked with the blood of Palestinians.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, Student Day, also known as the Day Against Global Arrogance in Iran, has been commemorated throughout the country on Sunday. Many students have taken part in the rallies reaffirming their support for a strong and independent Iran. And though it has been 45 years since Iranian students took over the American embassy in Tehran, due to its interference in that time, the new revolution, these young people seem to be as adamant as those who have come before them to want their country not to be subservient to global arrogance. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Out of London, Chairman of Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masoud Shajadeh. And out of Houston, activist and commentator, Mohsen Naqvi.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you both for being with me. Welcome to the program. I'm going to start it off with Masoud. Your perspective, I mean, it's been 45 years since, of course, that incident that took place when the Iranian students took over the American embassy. There have been some since that time, even inside of this country, who say that that was a mistake. Perhaps that put us on the wrong road with the United States. However, the leader of the revolution yesterday was talking about how important this step was and to where we are today. Your overall take, Masoud.
Thank you for such a good question. The reality is that it's United States which has been on the wrong side of the history when it comes to liberation and independence of nations. You know, long before the revolution, I was in United States in Bay Area, and the way that we were all standing as a students in Berkeley and elsewhere against the oppression of the war of Vietnam and what United States was unleashing in that part of the world and committing crimes against humanity, the carpet bombing and, you know, the massacres. Really, the reality is that the students, be it in United States then or in Iran later on, or indeed right now around the world, have always stood against oppression and colonialism and its ugly impact worldwide. And I think really it would be unthinkable if students anywhere in the world would not stand up at times like this. And we're visually seeing that right now, right across the globe, how university students from United States, from East, West, from you know, Europe, Middle East, you know, all around the world are united, standing against the war crime, against oppression, against colonialism, against abuse which the West is committing. And I have to say that it's not just the whole of the West. We are talking about 15% the politician and a special group of elites who are committing these crimes. Even in the West, 75 to 85% of ordinary people in United States and Europe and elsewhere are standing and saying enough is enough. And these minority are ignoring democracy, ignoring international law, ignoring the national laws, and are supporting crimes against humanity and genocide.
All right. Well, Mohsen, your thoughts, because I just want to clear this up, too, for also some of our viewers. When we look at what happened 45 years ago and those students taking over the American embassy because it was interfering in the revolution. And there are many who say, well, you broke international law. And, of course, we see what international law entails these days. Your perspective about the importance of that move or not in where we see the Islamic Republic of Iran today?
Well, yes. So we see student movements in the U.S. and in other parts of the world today as well. And we saw that here in the U.S., student encampments became news in on all conventional media outlets. But the thought of a group of students or the masses among student movements taking over the embassy of an entire country is something that is unfathomable for some of the movement that we see here today. And so that goes on to show the resilience and the political awareness and the organizational maturity that Iranian people, and especially their students, had during the 1979 revolution. They say that in Iran, in the Islamic Republic of Iran, they may have difference of opinions amongst each other, but they all unite on one thing, and that is recognizing the enemy. They're very good and very mature at doing that. That also goes on to show the fact that Iran has been a civilization for years and years and years, and that the 1979 revolution gave this mature people an Islamic direction that led to that victory. And right after that revolution, calling out the U.S. Empire, and the students taking over the embassy, calling it the Den of Spies, because, as Rehber also said, the Den of Espionage, as Rehber also said, that this wasn't a political act. This wasn't an act to just show what they're doing. But as a matter of fact, the reason why that embassy was taken over was because there was no doubt that this embassy was not really an embassy. It was operating as a safe haven for spies, because as we all know, within an embassy, the country doesn't have jurisdiction. And so the government wasn't in a position to enter into the embassy, and hence the students rioted, the students took power, they understood the atrocities that the U.S. empire was committing. And I really feel that this frustration that the Iranians had towards the Western-supported monarchy of Reza Shah Pahlavi, and how the movement in the Islamic Republic of Iran led by Imam Khomeini called out the Zionist regime, called out the U.S. empire for the arrogant, oppressive powers they were, it really kind of assembled and blossomed when the youth of the country, when the students of that country showed the world that the Iranians are on one page, they support the revolution, they love Imam Khomeini, they support this new form of government, they don't have support for any arrogant powers, and they showed this extreme form of love for peace and solidarity towards all oppressive people by taking over that embassy.
All right. Well, Masoud, you know, it's interesting. We're talking about the U.S. Embassy because just yesterday, actually, the U.S. Embassy in Lebanon, there was information that came out and said how it's been blocking humanitarian assistance between Iraq and Lebanon. Also, how the embassy requires information about the flights and everyone who's on it landing in Beirut. Isn't this symbolic of really what happened 45 years ago, that interference in the domestic affairs of countries? And, of course, in the case of Iran, as we know, after the students had gotten the information from the former embassy, from their papers that they were trying to destroy, about how they were plotting to overthrow the country, even to assassinate Imam Khomeini, I mean, the leader of the revolution, yesterday talked about it, that don't think that all of this started on that day. There is a long history of this type of antagonistic behavior by the United States towards Iran.
Yeah, there is amnesia when people talking about the West, when they're talking about the interference of the United States around the world, and their embassy's involvement, you know, Mossadegh time, and, you know, what happened in South America. You know, there's so many examples, which is very difficult to come to any conclusion except that U.S. embassies around the world are centers for espionage and coup d'etat and CIA and so forth activities. There is a saying that the only reason there has never been a coup d'etat and a coup in the United States is because there is no American embassy in the United States.
Right.
And, you know, this is unfortunately not just a joke, but a reality. You know, these embassies, and, you know, you look at the size of the American embassy in Iraq, it's a city. You know, indeed, the similar sort of situation in some of the African countries. And right now they're building one in Nigeria, which is going to be the biggest in Africa and so forth. Mm. These are not for arranging visas and commercial arrangement between two countries. These are centers to commit espionage and commit acts of aggression against independent state and make sure that they are not independent and they are indeed dependent on Americans' wishes. So this was exactly what happened at the time of the revolution.
Right.
Iranian students didn't want a repeat of what happened at the time of Mossadegh.
Well, most of the leader of the revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, addressed the students in commemoration with this day and talked about the importance of making sure this commemoration takes place annually, the commemoration and understanding and not forgetting global arrogance, and especially if we look at the situation that is happening in the world today, do you think that the lines are becoming more clear when we look at, especially in relation with the U.S. Zionist genocide that is taking place, that these lines are becoming more clear and it is very, very important to make sure we understand the role of global arrogance and to stand against it?
Absolutely. The fact that Reber has mentioned that this should continue to be celebrated every single year, it's one of those recommendations that Reber gives to keep that culture alive, that culture of standing up against global arrogance. And Reber consistently and continues to focus on consistent annual actions to keep these narratives alive. We're seeing students protesting all over the Islamic Republic. We're seeing them protest and celebrate the fact that these students were able to take over the Den of Spies, aka the U.S. Embassy. And there's a lot of wisdom in that. When the revolution happened, Imam Khomeini said, "Marg bar Amerika," death to America, death to American foreign policy. Imam Khomeini said that no matter what happens, that this new form of government will not compromise on their values and their principles, no matter how many sanctions the Islamic Republic will be imposed upon, no matter what aggression the Islamic Republic will face. And they have sacrificed generals over generals, Shahid Qasem Soleimani being one of them, and we've seen other generals being killed in this movement, especially in Syria as well. And we've seen them take a stance, a conscious stand, in which, as Reber also said, that not only is there military, but also knowledge and technology. These are areas where students have to focus on in order to defeat this arrogant power. And we are seeing these wisdoms and these thoughts of Imam Khomeini and Imam Khamenei really, really blossom today. So, and without the Islamic Republic, without the revolution in Iran, there would not have been an axis of resistance. There would not have been a Hezbollah, a Hamas, a PFLP, an Islamic Jihad. This is now a matter of fact. The region of West Asia would have been incapable of confronting the Zionist regime without the thoughts, the ideologies, the organizational structure of the Islamic Republic of Iran, which has literally exported its ideology. They have exported their knowledge and their weapons, and they have empowered the axis of resistance. They don't work like the U.S. The Islamic Republic has allies in the region, and it is this very strategy that has now. It's the fact that the West Asia can finally gain freedom from the clutches of the empire. That fact almost is certain now. And Shahid Qasem Soleimani mentions this in his speeches. Sayyid Nasrullah has also mentioned this in his speeches. The end of the Zionist regime, that the true revenge to Shahid Qasem Soleimani's martyrdom will be the eradication of the U.S. empire's existence on West Asia. And we see that happening today. The Zionists have never been as weak as they are today. The U.S. empire and their bases have never been as vulnerable as they are today. We see the Iraqi resistance engaging with them directly. We see the Yemeni resistance engaging with them directly. It right. all started off when the students and Imam Khomeini confronted them directly.
Masoud, we also heard from the leader of the revolution addressing his students and saying that he wanted them to know that Iran will do whatever it has to protect itself, to protect the country from a military perspective or equipment-wise, politically, whatever it takes, the country will do. And the leaders of the country, the politicians of the country, they will make sure that this is being taken care of. I mean, your thoughts on what that means exactly.
Well, it is important, extremely important, to make sure that what was gained out of the revolution with the blood of those who stood up, all those who gave everything, be it at the, immediately at the time of revolution or on the imposed war, and indeed afterward, needs to be sustained, this independent, this empowerment of people, this this victory needs to be nurtured and protected. And that means that more sacrifice needs to be made at any particular time when it's in danger. And we are seeing this conflict between those who want independence, those who want some sort of world which based on international law, on an order, and some sort of concept of morality are on one side. And then those are who are standing for genocide and genocidal act as a means of creating a world, be it Netanyahu, be it Biden, or be it European leadership. As I said before, they are in a minority. They, even within the West, they represent only between 15 to 20% population. Overwhelming majority of us, be it those of us who live in London, Paris, New York, Berlin, or living in West Asia or beyond that, we are demanding an end to this genocidal policy, and we don't want to have that as a future for our next to come. This is there, we are seeing, despite opposition to it, both internally in the West and externally, those are set completely committed to these genocidal acts, and they're supporting it financially, militarily, politically, economically, they're putting everything into it. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, the rest of us have to rise up to this challenge, not just to keep independence of places like Iran or help Palestinians to get independent or defend the Lebanese or Yemenis. It's actually the future of humanity is at the stake. And for that, I believe we all have to rise up and make sure that we will not allow those acts of genocide to be victorious, and therefore, you know, acts of resistance, which includes all of us, overwhelming majority of people around the world, need to stand up.
Right. Well, Mohsen, according to the leader of the revolution, the U.S. and the Zionists will receive a crushing response for what they've done. Of course, they have attacked Iran. And he said this is not about revenge. This is about Iran's right, whether we're talking about international law from a moral perspective, from a religious perspective. It is Iran's right, and definitely Iran will give a crushing response. Your thoughts?
I'm glad when leaders say in Nasrullah, they say there is when they say that, that means there will be a response, there will be a revenge. They know that for a fact. When it will happen, that is a card that the Islamic Empire, that the Islamic Republic always keeps with themselves. Rabbi also goes on to mention the importance of, as you mentioned, the readiness, the military capability, the arms, and political actions. And the reason why it has been possible for the Islamic Republic to conduct operations such as True Promise 1, True Promise 2, and True Promise 3 is coming up soon, is because the guidance that Rehber has given, it is these guidances that are now taking shape into reality. He mentions military readiness, armaments. We see how the thought of the revolution and this fight against global arrogance has been spread throughout the region, in Yemen, in Iraq, in Lebanon, in different parts of the West Bank, and obviously Gaza.
20 seconds. Go ahead.
This wasn't possible before the revolution. And so, and then as far as political actions are concerned, we see the alliances that the Islamic Republic has been able to construct. May that be in the shape of BRICS or the Shanghai administration. So it is this readiness that Rehber speaks about, and Iran is without a doubt ready to confront global arrogance today.
All right, and on that note, thank you both for being with us. Masoud Shajadeh, Chairman of Islamic Human Rights Commission out of London, Mohsen Naqvi, activist and commentator out of Houston. Thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Goodbye.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله.
Answering your doubts and questions. And questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan? La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. We're welcome to another episode on Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. I am Atal, the host of this program. Sheikh Ahmad Danish is a special guest speaker from the Islamic House of Qom to answer today's questions. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Wa alaikum assalam. Hope all of you are well.
All right. For today's discussion, we want to talk about Palestine and the people of Gaza, of course, from the theological point of view. I mean, Islamically speaking and according to the Islamic belief systems, what we are encouraged to do at such situations. Are there any special recommendations for us Muslims in order to contribute to our fellow Muslim brothers and sisters who are oppressed in any part of the world or not? Okay, Sheikh, with all these atrocities and cruelties that we see in Gaza done by Israel, what should Muslims do in order to help their fellow Muslim brothers and sisters?
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Yes, a question that comes to mind of every believer, that in these trying times, what we can do to help our brothers and sisters, not only in Palestine, but also in Lebanon, right? And so,
yes,
one of the general principles that we have from the Holy Quran is expressed to us in this verse of the Holy Quran, which says that لَكِنِ الرَّسُولُ وَالَّذِينَ آمَنُوا مَعَا جَاهِدُوا بِأَمْوَالِهِمْ وَأَنفُسِهِمْ وَأُولَٰئِكَ لَهُمُ الْخَيْرَاتُ وَأُولَٰئِكَ هُمُ الْمُفْلِحُونَ. That is, those people who are with the Holy Prophet, and we consider ourselves to be the descendants of those who have been with the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. They, first of all, they believe in the message of the Holy Prophet and the message of the Holy Quran. And then, جَاهِدُوا بِأَمْوَالِهِمْ وَأَنفُسِهِمْ. Right? Yes. And so, this verse of Surah At-Tawbah, verse number 88, says that these people strive in the cause of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala with their amwal and with their anfus. The first part comes with their amwal. So, if at a certain stage your money, your property, your wealth can help those people in need, your brothers and sisters, yes, who are fighting in Lebanon, in Palestine, we are recommended to contribute towards their cause with our property, with our wealth, with our material resources. But if a need comes and a time comes when you yourself should be going out there and helping them out with all that you have, and a time or a point in time comes when you're going by yourself and fighting for the cause of Islam, yes, is recommended, then you have to be willing to go there. Mm-hmm. So this is the overall principle that the Holy Quran says. And another principle that the Holy Quran tells us is that أَشِدَّاءُ عَلَى الْكُفَّارِ وَرُحَمَاءُ بَيْنَهُمْ.
Yes.
That is, those people who are with the Holy Prophet wasallam, are those people who are strict and unforgiving on the kuffar,
yes,
and they are ruhama, merciful amongst themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so we always need to be merciful with our mu'mineen brothers, not only in the country that we are living in, but we are told that we Muslims are a body. That is, if one part of the body feels the pain,
all
the entire body feels the pain.
Mm-hmm.
And so we need to be concerned about our brothers in Palestine and in Lebanon and wherever they are being oppressed.
All right, that's right.
So this is the general principle.
And this is not only limited to Palestine or Lebanon, but any part of the world,
any
isn't
part
it?
Of the world.
I mean, Islam, since Islam is a communal and collective religion,
true,
it has concerns about all the people and all the followers all around the world, regardless of their denomination. I mean, this is not the time to say that, okay, he's a Sunni brother, I'm a Shia brother, let's get held the Shia ones and not the Sunni ones. This is not so. As if we could see Islamic Republic of Iran's population, more than 80-90% are Shia. The administration is a Shia one, but it's helping our Sunni brethren, for example, cool, in Lebanon and Palestine. But the case is about humanity, I think, isn't it? I mean, it's about humanitarian aspect also is very much important, something that Islam has valued very much. That is the honor and the dignity of a human being in general. I think we have in the Holy Quran that killing a person is as if you are killing the whole humanity, isn't it?
True.
Killing a nafs is as if you are killing a whole community or a society. So that's why even the life of a person, and just look at the footage. I mean, the innocent children and the women are being bombarded, burnt alive. They are being killed, you know, on the streets, shelterless, foodless, homeless, you know, and unfortunately, sad footage. You cannot even imagine it. In the 21st century, you can see such things, you know, such unfortunately footage and videos and the pictures over the social media.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
So one aspect is the physical help. I mean, in terms of helping, in terms of contribution, in terms of sadaqah, in terms of, for example, I've heard that recently Rahbar said that for Radd Mazalim, okay, you can pay, it is jayaz to pay it, for example, for the people of Lebanon. Or, for example, some of the religious authorities of Maharaja said that one part of the khums and zakat must be paid, for example, for the people of Lebanon. And this is the Islamic economic system that is at work, sure, and helping now. What about the spiritual one? I mean, spiritually, what can we do? Are there any recommendations for us? Or are they working? I mean, for example, any type of surah or supplication to be read out, to be recited, and helping such people over there?
True. So we have various suggestions from the traditions that we have. We have various prayers that have been related to us and narrated to us by from the holy imams, alayhimus salam. And one of the prayers specifically for those fighting on the Muslim borders is one of the prayers from the Sahifa Sajjadiyah. As you know, that Sahifa Sajjadiyah is a book of prayers, and is considered the Zabur Ali Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, the Psalms of the Ahl al Bayt,
Psalms of Islam. Yes,
yes,
yes.
And so, one of the prayers of Sahifa Sajjadiyah from Imam Zainul Abidin, mm-hmm, is specifically about the people who are fighting on the Muslim borders, and it's such a beautiful prayer. It's such a comprehensive prayer that It is praying for those people who are fighting on Muslim borders. And this is prayer number 27, if I'm correct, from Sahifa Sajjadiyah. And some of the verses we can go over and see how beautiful this entire dua is.
Yes.
For example, one of the parts says that the beginning of this dua says, Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali wa hassan